It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about tiny terrors and relocation regrets. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. I also wanted to take a moment to thank you for all your donations. Every share, donation, and comment of support helps. Let's keep building this together. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of D.B. Anthony and founder Craig Groshek, our voice talents, Kevin Barberi, Danielle Hewitt, Otis Gyrie, myself, Steve Taylor, and welcome to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights newcomers, Matthew Ferrugia and Mike Lauer. Now, get your ticket ready, take your seat in our Theater of the Minds, and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by D.B. Anthony and performed by Kevin Barberi, Danielle Hewitt, Otis Gyrie, and myself, Steve Taylor. In it, we meet a man named Harold, a man whose hatred of Halloween turns deadly when children in eerie costumes target him, demanding candy and exacting brutal revenge for his refusal. Now, without further ado, I present to you, Knock, Knock, Knock.
Harold sits in his lazy boy recliner in front of his TV, turning it onto the 12 o'clock news. The local anchorman, Doug Harrowin, appears on the screen in a black suit with a pumpkin pattern accompanied by an orange tie, resting on a black dress shirt. Below him, a caption lined the bottom of the screen in bold white letters, surrounded by a red rectangle to draw the viewer's attention to it.
Good evening, Landport. As always, I'm Doug Harrowin. This evening, we will be going over some tips on how to keep safe during this spooky night.
Harold quickly changes the channel, mumbling under his breath, "Stupid fucking holiday," as the screen turns black, before revealing Jamie Lee Curtis hiding in a closet. Seconds later, Michael Myers will start breaking the closet door open, causing her to scream. Harold changes the channel again. This time, Betsy Palmer appears on the screen. She was giving a monologue about how kids bullied her son and drowned him in the lake. Harold cut her speech off by changing the channel. If anything had something to watch, it would be the Channel 6 News. They cover world news rather than just local and national. They wouldn't cover something as stupid as a shitty fake holiday. Last time he tuned in, they were covering serious things like the Russian invasion of Ukraine, conflicts in the Middle East, and rising tension in Asia. The screen changes to a commercial for Life Alert. A woman looking to be in her late 60s was laying on the ground shouting for help. Harold chuckles to himself while he sips on his coffee, waiting for the commercial to be over. That could never be him. He didn't survive two wars to die because he can't lift himself up off the floor like some type of helpless turtle. When the commercial ends, the screen flashes with a blue globe with all the continents outlined on it in white. Channel 6 World News was about to begin. The graphic of the globe fades away, revealing Todd Mosley sitting at the news desk. Unlike Doug Heroin, Todd was wearing a casual suit that looked to be either black or dark navy blue.
Hello, I'm Todd Mosley, and welcome to the World News at Noon. Today, we will continue our coverage of the Ukrainian counteroffensive into Russia as they continue to gain more and more ground, forcing Russia to shift resources from their own invasion force in order to counter the rapid Ukrainian advance. Then, we will shift our focus to the South China Sea, where there continues to be an increase in presence from the Chinese naval fleet, sparking concern they are getting ready for their own invasion of Taiwan. But first, we go to Samantha West with a short segment on Halloween traditions and some tips that will keep you safe during tonight's festivities.
Harold cuts him off by turning off the television in frustration. Stupid fucking holiday. Nothing to watch on the damn TV but stupid horror movies. Halloween this, Halloween that. Fucking people think the world just stops turning for these shitty holidays. Harold says aloud, looking over to the dog bed to his right, where his English bulldog Echo was laying looking at the TV. Harold always hated Halloween. To him, it was the stupidest of holidays, even worse than Christmas, Easter, and Thanksgiving. As a child, he never understood it. He never had the desire to get dressed up to go trick-or-treating like the other kids. To him, that was stupid and a waste of time. Not like his mother would have allowed him to go trick-or-treating even if he wanted to. He was raised in what his mother called a pure Christian household. Everything children his age were into was labeled satanic or witchcraft, especially Halloween. He didn't share his mother's religious views. However, he did inherit her pure hatred of the holiday. Kids expected to get candy for nothing more than getting dressed up in a stupid costume of a ridiculous fictional character. And if they didn't, they'd egg houses, throw rolls of toilet paper all over them, and even light bags of dog crap on fire and set them on people's front porch, expecting the occupant to put it out by stomping on it. Some would call those harmless pranks or Halloween traditions. Last year, one of those harmless pranks caused a house fire that destroyed the front porch of the Landon's home while they were out partying and getting drunk. That was another thing that he hated about Halloween. Adults were all out partying the night away without a care in the world. They used the holiday as an excuse to act half their age and party like they are teenagers again. They neglect their responsibilities, drink all night, then proceed to drive themselves home. There are always stories on the news on November 1st about drunk driving accidents, and they were always on their way home from one of those parties. It was just another tragic American tradition. Those stories would usually accompany stories of razor blades or needles being found in some kid's candy. That was despite the constant warning to always check the candy. The problems of the world don't stop for no stupid holiday. Ain't that right, Echo? Harold says while standing up from his chair. Echo looks up at him, carefully watching to see if he was going into the kitchen or not. He was. Echo follows him and watches as he pours himself a second cup of coffee and mixes his sugar in with it.
You know, Echo, this time of year is the worst. It goes from Halloween to Turkey Day to fucking Christmas and New Year's. Messes with our damn TV schedule. There's nothing good on. Those damn slasher flicks take over the TV for all of the fall season now. If I wanted to see blood and guts, I'd close my damn eyes and dream about the wars I fought. Then we get those damn gay Christmas movies, all happy and cheery. Makes me sick. I spent all these damn holidays fighting my way through Asian jungles. Hell, I spent one Halloween washing my best friend's blood off my uniform. Of course, that was after I watched him eat a bullet from a damn gook's assault rifle.
Echo whimpers at him.
Ah, geez, boy, I'm sorry. Here I am reminiscing about the good old days and I forgot to feed you. I'll give you a little extra for making you wait.
Harold reaches for a random bowl and fills it with kibble, placing it on the ground in front of Echo before walking back into the living room and sitting back in his recliner. He wonders what he's going to do. The house was quiet, except for the sound of Echo's dog tag jingling while he eats his lunch. After a few minutes of listening to the jingle of the dog tag, Harold is startled, causing him to spill his coffee on his lap as the rhythmic sound of metal jingling suddenly stops and turns into the sound of Echo breaking and scrambling his way to the front door.
God damn it! What's all the ruckus for, Echo? Ain't nobody even knock on the...
There were two light knocks on the door, just loud enough to hear over the sound of Echo's barking.
God damn it, are kids already trick-or-treating? Too damn early for this shit. Shouldn't they be in school?
He stands from his chair and angrily makes his way to the front door and nudges Echo out of the way so he can look through the peephole. On the other side of the door is a small child looking to be 5 or 6. He was dressed in a ridiculous soldier costume modeled after the uniforms Americans wore during the Second World War. Of course he had to be dressed as a soldier. Harold opens the door, ferociously channeling his inner drill sergeant.
Trick or treat!
What in the fuck do you think you're doing? Can you not read all the signs saying do not trespass? How about the ones saying private property?
I thought they were decorations,
the child replies in a passive, apologetic tone, his eyes tearing up.
Well, you thought wrong, dipshit. Take that uniform off. You're a disgrace. A real soldier would have respected the signs, you fucking idiot.
The little boy is unable to respond. Tears fall down his cheeks and he is shaking. A dark spot begins to form on his pants as urine leaks from his bladder and down his leg, pooling on the wooden porch beneath him.
Now you're pissing yourself on my porch? What a fucking pussy. You wouldn't last 1 second in the military. Now get off my damn property, you little insignificant twerp. Go cry at home to your fucking mommy like the little bitch you are.
The little boy sprints away, crying all the way down the driveway, eventually leaving Harold's view.
And take that stupid uniform off. You look ridiculous. Come back here and I'll sick my dog on you.
Harold closes the door and begins laughing hysterically.
Hey, did you see his face, boy? He even pissed himself.
Harold walks to his bedroom to change his pants and clean the coffee off of himself. Echo doesn't follow him. Instead, he retreats back to the kitchen to finish his lunch.
Boy would have never made it in the infantry. Kids nowadays are too soft. With their video games and their social medias and all that cartoon bullshit, makes me happy I grew up when I did. Learned to be a real man.
After cleaning himself up and changing his pants, Harold makes his way to his office where he sits at his desk.
Time to get some writing done since there ain't shit on television.
On Harold's desk is a typewriter, accompanied by several thick-bound documents with various titles. He picks one up that is titled, How I Survived the Cold War, and thumbs through it.
Can't believe these commie bastards keep rejecting my submissions. It's like nobody knows what good writing is anymore. They'd rather publish another bullshit love story by some socialist bitch than a veteran who speaks his damn mind.
He loads the typewriter with a blank piece of paper and begins by titling this new book, The Battles of the Cold War. He spends a few minutes typing before ripping the page out of the typewriter and tossing it into the garbage bin beside him in frustration.
Same fucking story I've written 1,000 damn times. Of course, I didn't get no damn medals for the shit I did, but it's all damn true. Unlike that diddliest sniper bullshit, that bastard was nothing compared to Chuck.
He reloads the typewriter with another piece of blank paper when there's a knock at the door. This knock was louder and resonated through the house. To his surprise, Echo doesn't start barking as he usually does every time someone knocks on the door.
Who the fuck could that be now? I swear to God, if it's another little brat's trick-or-treating, next year I'll put up an electric fence that'll teach those little twerps.
As he storms his way out of the office, there is another knock at the door. There was something unsettling about the knock. 3 quick but firm knocks on the door that seemed to say, trick or treat. For a moment, he hesitates, even looking through the peephole. All his instincts were telling him danger was behind the door. The sound of Echo's dog tag jangling as he walks his way beside him causes him to flinch and almost kick him.
Damn it, Echo! You know better than to sneak up on me like that!
Echo doesn't reply. Instead, he whimpers at the door as if he also senses the danger that lurks on the other side and is afraid. Harold hesitates for a moment, then leans forward against the door and looks through the peephole. On the other side was another child. His costume consisted of a tattered gray trench coat with poorly sewn-on patches. On his head sat a jack-o'-lantern mask. But it wasn't a normal jack-o'-lantern mask. It looked as if it had been rotting in the November sun the day after Halloween. after being smashed in by some teenage punks. In his hand was a burlap sack that seemed to be filled with something. He could barely see behind the kid, but it looked as if it was leaking something and had been for a while. A trail of red led from behind the child down the driveway. Even though he sees that it is just a child behind the door, the hair on the back of his neck stands at attention, something it hadn't done since he fought his first battle in the Korean Peninsula. For a moment, he contemplates simply ignoring the child and walking away. Is he going to go away? Harold takes a deep breath, channeling his inner drill sergeant again, and opens the door.
Can't any of you twerps read? This is private property. Get the hell off my porch.
The child doesn't even flinch. Instead, he simply opens his burlap sack and holds it open as if suggesting Harold was in fact going to put something in the sack, and he wasn't taking no for an answer. Harold takes another deep breath, getting ready to yell again, and that is when he notices a pungent odor. It was the fishy smell of a rotten and moldy pumpkin with something hidden underneath it. He almost chokes on the air as it goes down his throat and into his lungs. The underlying smell was something familiar, something he hadn't smelled in a long time, yet he recognized it almost right away. It was the stench of death. Harold thinks for a moment and examines the child's costume. This wasn't the average overpriced costume that they sell at the stores. The jack-o'-lantern on his head was so realistic that it sent chills down Harold's spine. The orange of the mask looks to have a flesh-like texture to it instead of appearing cheap and rubbery. There are no eyes beyond the black triangles of its face, just darkness that seems to be staring back at him. Even the tattered, filthy trench coat seems to have come straight out of a reject bin from the Salvation Army. It might have been a designer brand at one point in its life. The trench coat itself was oversized for the child, so much so that it dragged on the ground and hid his legs. What kind of costume was this? The child jerks the burlap sack forward as if demanding Harold put something in the bag.
Didn't you hear me, you little brat? Get off my damn property. I ain't got nothing for you. Take your damn leaking bag and get the hell off my porch.
The child jerks the bag forward again in the same demanding way.
Are you deaf, kid? Let me say it loud enough for you to hear. I ain't got no goddamn candy. I don't participate in this stupid goddamn holiday.
The child drops the bag to his side and his mask seems to change. The smile that every jack-o'-lantern has turns into an angry frown, and the eyes narrow to the point it appears to be giving Harold an angry death glare.
Oh, did I upset you, you little brat? Why don't you go cry to your mommy about it?
The child reaches into its burlap sack and takes out what looks to be an orange water balloon filled with dark red liquid and tosses it at Harold, hitting him in the face, sending the red liquid splashing all over him and leaking down his front, turning his shirt from white to red.
What the fuck, you little bastard? What was in that balloon?
The child throws another one that hits Harold in his chest and knocks the air out of his lungs, causing Harold to start coughing.
God damn it! Damn it, you little brat!
The child runs away while laughing hysterically. The laugh was unsettling. Goosebumps began to form on Harold's arms and legs. Just who the hell was that kid? Was that even a kid? Harold contemplates going after him, but he knows he'd never catch him. Not with his bum leg. It was the one thing that reminded him of his old age. If he was younger, he would have caught up to that boy and gave him the ass-whooping his mother should be giving him for what he did. Instead, he'll probably go home with plenty of candy without any consequences. He wonders how many people he has hit with those balloons, before shifting his focus to wondering what was inside them. He rushes to his bathroom to wash it off of him, but not before catching a glance of himself in the bathroom mirror. Only the image was off. He was his younger self again. Instead of his white shirt and khaki pants, he was wearing his old military uniform. The only thing that remained was the red liquid, which he was still drenched in. There was no more questioning what the mystery liquid was. Harold rips his shirt off and starts scrubbing it vigorously under the running water of the bathroom sink. It wasn't coming out, no matter how hard he scrubbed. In that moment, he was back at the forward operating base in Northern Korea, scrubbing blood and brain matter out of clothes. The sound of the child laughing can be heard echoing throughout the house, followed by the sound of three loud knocks on the door.
"Goddamn brat must have come back for more."
Harold storms his way from the bathroom to the front door, like the younger version of himself he saw in the mirror getting ready to scream at the Army's latest recruits. In his anger, he doesn't hesitate or look through the peephole to see who is on the other side of the door. Instead, his rage causes him to rip the door open, almost forgetting to turn the knob. To his surprise, it wasn't a child behind the door. Before him stood a young, beautiful woman that didn't look a day over 25. The only off-putting thing about her is the angry scowl that sat on her otherwise beautiful face.
"Did you scream at my son and call him a dipshit and an insignificant twerp and make him come home crying with piss in his pants?"
she says in an aggravated tone that matches her scowl. For a moment, he was caught off guard and didn't know how to reply. If looks could kill, she would have just committed murder.
"Well, care to explain yourself? He's refusing to come back out. You ruined his Halloween."
She wasn't asking for an explanation. She was demanding it.
"Well, he shouldn't have trespassed on my property,"
Harold replies in a cold, passive tone, still feeling caught off guard.
"He's just a kid. He doesn't know any better. He thought that all the signs were just decorations."
"Well, they aren't, and I don't appreciate you also trespassing on my property and yelling at me either. Now get off my property, or I'll call the police."
"Call the police? You're lucky I don't call the police on you for what you did to my son. I'm not leaving until you apologize."
"Fine. I'm sorry. Sorry your son is an annoying little crybaby twerp just like his mother. Now get off my property!"
Harold doesn't allow her to reply and slams the door in her face. He watches through the peephole as her face changes from an angry scowl to a shocked gasp. She appears to contemplate knocking on the door again before shaking her head and mouthing the word, "whatever," before making her way down the driveway.
"I crack myself up," Harold says to himself. "Did you hear that bitch echo? Coming out of my property and yelling at me. I swear, each generation gets more and more entitled."
He looks down towards the floor where Echo would normally be sitting while he answers the door, and is surprised that Echo isn't sitting there. Thinking back, he doesn't remember hearing Echo bark or scurry his way to the door.
"Echo? Where are you, boy? Come here, boy."
Echo doesn't come.
"Echo?"
Harold looks in the kitchen to see if Echo went back to finish eating, but he doesn't find him, nor is his bowl empty. He searches the living room where he normally takes a nap after finishing a meal, but he's not there either.
"Echo? Did you let yourself out the doggy door to go to the bathroom?"
Harold makes his way from the living room through the kitchen and out his back door onto the back porch. The backyard was empty except for a few squirrels chasing each other up a tree. If Echo was back here, he would be the third party in the chase, barking at the base of the tree. The knock at the door causes the hair on the back of his neck to stand. Though he was in the backyard, it was loud enough for its sound to echo through the house and into Harold's ears. It was a whisper in his ear that said, "Trick or treat." He wanted nothing more than to ignore the knocking and let whoever or whatever was on the other side of the door knock until their hand fell off, but something told him that wouldn't stop it. He makes his way from the back porch to the front door and hesitates to open it. He was getting the same feeling of danger as when the second kid knocked on the door, if that was a kid.
"Who's there?"
he shouts through the door, hoping for an answer. He leans forward and peers through the peephole. The child on the other side of the door is so short that he can only see the top of his head. His instincts were still telling him not to open the door.
"Go away! I ain't got no candy!"
Harold rips the door open, He is greeted by the putrid smell of rotting flesh and a small boy in a skeleton costume. The smell is enough to make him throw up in his mouth. On closer inspection of the child's outfit, it appears he has actual bones strapped to him. His mask even appeared to be the face of a human skull. There was a large hole in the shirt of the costume where it appeared that a chunk of flesh had been ripped off of the boy, revealing his own rib. Harold had seen similar holes ripped in men in Korea and later Vietnam. It looked too real to be makeup. The child had a burlap sack with him that appeared to have something heavy in it, too heavy for the small boy to lift. Behind the bag was a trail in the dirt leading from the front porch to around the back of the house. Like the first kid's sack, this one appears to be leaking red liquid. The only difference is, whatever was in the bag appears to have just started to leak. After the first child pelted him with the balloons filled with it, Harold knew that the red liquid pooling on his porch was blood. But what is bleeding in the sack?
"You sick little fuck. What's in the sack?"
The child doesn't answer. He holds out a bloody hand which is balled into a fist with his palm facing up before slowly flipping his hand over, letting small white objects that appear to be pebbles fall out of his hand one by one, each making a small thudding noise as they bounce off the wood of the porch before coming to a rest on the porch. Harold's jaw drops. When the pebbles came to a rest, it was easy for him to tell they weren't pebbles at all. They were the teeth of a small animal. Not just any animal. They were the teeth of a small dog. Two of his questions had just been answered. The small child laughs as Harold slams the door shut and runs to his phone in the kitchen and dials 911. The laughter can be heard echoing throughout the house and seems to resonate off the walls, causing it to sound as though there was more than one child laughing.
911. What is the emergency?
A female voice answers.
Those brats killed my dog!
Harold replies with panic and sadness in his voice.
Who killed your dog, sir?
Those good-for-nothing brats. They've been harassing me all evening and trespassing on my property. They killed my dog!
Sir, are you saying trick-or-treaters killed your dog?
The child's laugh still echoes throughout the house.
Yes, and they are still here, laughing at my door.
All right, sir. Calm down. Are you sure it wasn't a prank?
Yes, I'm sure. They put his body in a burlap sack.
All right, sir. I have your location as 16 Camden Ave. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. Hurry up and send someone. They're still here. Can't you hear their laughter?
I'm dispatching an officer to your location now, sir, to investigate. Please, remain calm. It may just be a harmless prank.
Harmless prank. The operator's words enrage him. Every year they assume every call is nothing more than a prank.
Harmless prank? Tell that to my dead dog.
Harold slams the phone on the receiver.
I'll deal with this myself.
He rushes to the desk in his office and grabs a small wooden box. Inside the box is a loaded Colt 1911 and two magazines, each with 7 bullets in them. He racks the slide, chambering a bullet, and rushes to the door where the child can still be heard laughing.
I'll give you to the count of 3. If you don't leave, I'll empty my pistol through the door and blame it on shell shock.
The laughing doesn't stop.
1.
The laughing continues.
2.
Harold takes a deep breath as he contemplates what he is about to do. If the child hadn't harmed Echo, he would simply fire a couple of shots through the door above where the kid's head would be. Instead, he was enraged and letting his anger take full control. Killing Echo was crossing a line he thought would never be crossed, especially by a child. Maybe his mother was right, and kids' interests really were becoming more and more satanic with each generation. The police and media would probably chalk this whole situation up to a tragedy, a prank gone wrong, triggering an elderly war vet's PTSD. The worst part is Harold might end up in jail for defending himself or a loony bin just because some dumb twerps decided to take a prank too far.
3!
The laughing stops. Harold is relieved as he lowers his Colt to the ground. Was he really going to kill a child? Two firm knocks on the door startle him into raising the pistol again.
Who's there?
Harold, it's me, Sheriff Dickens.
A gravelly voice replies. Harold lowers his pistol. He takes a moment to gather himself before he opens the door.
Long time, Charles,
Harold says in a calm tone.
Too long, Harold. Haven't seen you at the VFW lately.
Dickens replies. Dickens was one of Harold's squad leaders during the early years of the Vietnam War. Dickens was responsible for sending Harold back to America, where he later became a drill instructor. He always resented him for taking him out of active combat, and he still does. Later, Dickens came back from the war, retired from the service, and became a deputy in the Landport Police Department. Later, the sheriff.
I heard some kids may be terrorizing you, so I decided I should come down here myself and see to the investigation personally.
They are doing more than terrorizing me. They killed Echo.
Harold's voice was no longer calm. He points to the ground where Echo's blood had been pooling beneath the burlap sack and where the teeth had been dropped. But any evidence of the incident was gone.
Harold, you okay? I know that sometimes Halloween can trigger things for us veterans.
But it was all just here. The child was just on my porch before you got here. Surely you saw him running away as you pulled up. You have to find that little bastard and his little friend. He was dressed as a skeleton.
Harold, there was nobody out here when I pulled up, and the only little boy I've seen in a skeleton outfit tonight was Harvey's boy. He was over on 8th Street on my way here. Way too far to have been here. The rest of the kids are dressed as comic or video game characters. Hell, I saw one kid in an inflatable costume that looked rather phallic. Damn near pissed myself laughing. I guess he was supposed to be some type of Fortnite character.
Harold can tell that Dickens was trying to put him at ease, but all it did was irritate him more. He must think he is crazy.
I ain't crazy, Dickens. That boy killed my dog.
Are you sure Echo didn't slip through that hole in the side of your fence there? Looks like something might have torn its way through it.
Harold was puzzled. He steps out of the house and looks around to the side at his fence. It did appear as though some type of animal had bent the metal wiring and created a large enough hole to enter and exit through.
It must have been how that little brat got Echo.
All right, I'll tell you what. I'll take a cruise around the neighborhood and see if I spot these kids. You said one was wearing a skeleton costume. What was the other one wearing?
Some type of pumpkin mask and a tattered trench coat. That first one threw balloons at me that were full of some type of blood.
Probably just corn syrup and food coloring. Look, when I find them, I'll ask them about Echo. Just don't worry too much. You might give yourself a heart attack. He might be just wandering the neighborhood right now.
Harold doesn't say anything. Instead, he just nods, accepting the fact that that is all Dickens can do. Dickens starts walking to his cruiser before stopping halfway and turning back towards Harold.
And one more thing. The Langdon's boy's mother came by the station to complain about you screaming at her boy. They're new in town and didn't know of your reputation on Halloween. I told her that his costume must have triggered your PTSD. Anyway, you gave that boy a good scare and ruined his holiday. If you could just apologize to him, I'd appreciate it.
I ain't got no damn shell shock, and I ain't apologizing. They should apologize to me for coming onto my property expecting me to participate in their demonic holiday.
Never pegged you for the religious type. I'll be back to let you know what I find, if I find anything.
Harold makes his way back inside and slams the door behind him. He watches through the peephole as Dickens shakes his head and gets back into his car. The car seems to slowly pull away as if Dickens was combing the tree lines for signs of the children or Echo. His last words echo in Harold's mind. If I find anything. The question lingers on his mind. Would he find anything, or was it just another goose chase for him on this stupid holiday? The pranksters usually get away scot-free. They laugh about it until it's forgotten and then do it all again next year, even when the pranks go too far. Would these pranks be treated with such carelessness if they were treated as the actual crimes that they were? As Dickens' cruiser disappears down the driveway, Harold turns around and instantly spots the burlap sack on the floor in front of him.
Echo!
Harold shouts as he collapses to his knees and grabs the burlap sack, hugging it to his body mournfully. He didn't have to open the bag to know that it was Echo. For a moment, he mourns his dog before the sudden realization hits him. How did the sack get into his house? The child's laughter can be heard all throughout the house.
Where are you, you little brat?
Harold shouts. Harold starts searching the house with his trusty Colt, leading the way to each room. He tears the place apart, searching every closet, cupboard, cabinet, and room. He even searches under and behind furniture. He doesn't find anything. When he has searched all the rooms, the laughter simply stops. Was it all in his head? Was he actually going crazy? The only proof he wasn't crazy was in the burlap sack. How could this all be fake if his dog was really in that sack? He contemplates for a moment opening it and seeing if it really was Echo. Was this a question he really wanted answered? No. He couldn't bear to see what those hooligans might have done to Echo. What they did to Echo. Harold picks up the sack and the weight only confirms to him that it is Echo. He carries the sack to the backyard and grabs a shovel from his tool shed. He spends the next few hours digging a hole that was far too large for Echo. The digging took his mind off of what was happening. It wasn't until the sun was setting and the air was colder that he realized that he had dug a human-sized grave. The knocking startled him awake in his chair. It had only been an hour since he buried Echo in the backyard. The sun was fully set. By now, all the kids in town were littering the streets in their costumes while their parents were out partying and drinking. Harold closes his eyes, wanting the night to end and the holiday to be over. He knew from the sound of the knock that whoever was on the other side of the door wasn't going away. He knew, without a doubt, that it was going to be one of those weird children.
"Just leave me alone! You brats have already taken my dog! What more can you take from me?"
Each knock was harder than the last.
"Just go away!"
Harold gets out of his chair and rushes to the door, opening it. The air behind it smells of sulfur and ash.
"Just go away, you stupid brat!"
The child was dressed in an old devil costume. Was he the devil? The horns appeared to actually be coming out of his head, with one having a broken tip. The cape was torn and tattered at the end as if it had been ancient. Even the red bodysuit seems to be his true skin. The only thing that he was missing was the fake, drawn-on mustache. The trident he held in his left hand was seemingly made out of real metal and sharp. In his other hand was a burlap sack similar to the ones that the other two children had, only his appeared to be empty.
"What do you want from me?"
The devil child holds the sack out and lets it flop open.
"You did this all for candy? You and your friends have terrorized me all night, and you did it for fucking candy?"
The devil child remains silent and shakes the bag at him, demanding Harold put something in it.
"I'm not giving you shit. Not after all of what you and your friends have done. Get off my damn property, or I'll get my gun and shoot you and your little friends."
Harold slams the door shut as hard as he can.
"Go on. Get out of here, you worthless twerp, or I'll send you to meet the devil myself."
Harold goes to grab his pistol from the side table next to his chair where he left it, but it is gone. The knocking seems to have doubled, as if there were now two fists knocking on the door.
"I said go away!"
It now sounded as if there were three fists knocking on the door.
"Just go away!"
The children on the other side of the door were all laughing in unison. Harold covers his ears and tries to pretend not to hear them.
"This isn't real. This can't be real."
The knocking seems to get harder and harder with each strike on the door, as if they are trying to beat the door down.
Just go away. I don't have any candy.
Their small fists were starting to break the wood of the door. Soon, they would break through it. The sound of their laughter and knocking was echoing through the house. The door was breaking even more, revealing the three children. The first child with the pumpkin head, the second child with the skull face, and the third child, the devil child. The door won't last much longer. Harold can feel his heart starting to beat faster and faster.
Just go away!
There was now a hole in the door large enough for children to fit through. The first one to enter is the one with the pumpkin head. The second, the skeleton boy. Lastly, the devil child. Harold gets up and stands in a fighting stance to defend himself as the kids surround him in his living room.
I survived two fucking wars. I ain't getting taken out by three little brats in stupid fucking Halloween costumes,
Harold shouts. The kids taunt him by dancing around him, laughing.
Who's first? I'll take you all on at once. I don't care.
Harold feels a sharp pain as he is slashed from behind with the devil child's trident. He lets out a pained scream as he feels a second strike on his left leg from a blunt object. A third blow to his right leg causes him to lose his balance and fall on his back. This causes the kids to laugh even more hysterically.
Just leave me alone, please,
Harold whimpers. The children ignore him and take turns jumping on and off as though he were a trampoline. He feels his ribs shatter in his chest as they continue to play with him. They start singing.
Trick or treat, smell my feet, give me something good to eat. If you don't, I won't be sad. I'll just make you wish you had.
I hope you enjoyed Knock Knock Knock, as written by D.B. Anthony and performed by Kevin Barbieri, Danielle Hewitt, Otis Gyre, and myself, Steve Taylor. Kevin Barbieri and Otis Gyre's talents were brought together in this episode to celebrate Kevin becoming a part of the Scary Stories Told in the Dark team. You can hear Kevin and Otis each and every Sunday. Our second tale of the evening is written by Chilling Tales for Dark Knights creator, the modern father of fear, Craig Groshek, and is performed by Matthew Ferrugia and Mike Lauer. In it, a man's quest to escape the horrors of a frozen lake leads him across continents, but he soon discovers that some terrors follow you no matter where you run. Now, without further ado, I present to you The Body in the Lake.
The winter winds howled through the trees surrounding Whispering Pines. A small, isolated town known more for its exceptional cold than for anything that would draw outsiders. The town was built on the edge of a large, deep body of water that locals called Blackwater Lake. A name that fit better in the depths of summer when its contents turned an inky black under the shadow of the surrounding pines. But in winter, the lake transformed, its surface freezing into a sheet of glass so clear that one could see straight through to the bottom, where old fishing traps and the detritus of past seasons lay trapped beneath the ice. Carl Donovan stood at the edge of the lake, his breath puffing out in clouds of vapor, his eyes narrowed against the sharp bite of the wind. He was a man of few words, a product of the kind of life that left little room for idle chatter. The deep gravel of his voice hinted at years of cigarette smoke and late nights spent by the fire, staring into the open flames and wondering what life might have been like had things turned out differently. But those thoughts were for another time. Now, there was only the ice and the sound that had woken him in the dead of night. It had started just after midnight, a low, rumbling hum that shook the walls of his cabin and pulled him from a deep, dreamless sleep. At first, He'd thought it was just the ice cracking, a natural enough occurrence when the temperatures dropped so low that the very air seemed to freeze in place. But as he listened, the sound grew, shifting in pitch and tone until it became something else entirely. Something that set his teeth on edge and sent a shiver down his spine that had nothing to do with the cold. Carl had lived by the lake for nearly a decade, moving out here after the events that had driven him from the city. Events he didn't like to talk about, not even to himself. He knew the lake better than most and had spent countless hours fishing in the summer and traversing its frozen surface in the winter. But this was new and familiar, disturbing him in a way he couldn't quite put into words. He tried to ignore it, pulling the covers up over his head and willing himself back to sleep. But the sound had persisted, growing louder and more insistent until he could no longer pretend it was just the ice. It was something more, something demanding an investigation. Pulling on his heavy coat and boots, Carl grabbed his flashlight and headed out into the night, the beam of light cutting through the darkness as he made his way down the narrow path to the lake. The snow crunched beneath his boots, the only sound in the otherwise silent night. Even the wind had died down, as if the world were holding its breath, waiting for something to happen. As he reached the edge of the lake, Carl stopped, his breath catching in his throat. The ice was clear, as it always was. But there was something different about it tonight. Something that made his heart race and his palms sweat despite the freezing cold. He stepped closer, shining his flashlight down onto the ice, and felt his stomach drop.
"What the hell?"
Carl muttered. There, beneath the surface, was the outline of a human body, floating just beneath the ice. The face was turned up towards him, eyes wide and unseeing, mouth open in a silent scream. The features were distorted by the refraction of the ice, but Carl could still make out enough to know that this was no ordinary drowning victim. He dropped to his knees, pressing his face closer to the ice, trying to get a better look. The body was perfectly preserved, as if it had been frozen in time, the cold preventing the usual process of decay. But that wasn't what made Carl's blood run cold. It was the fact that the body seemed to be moving, drifting slowly beneath the ice as if it were being pulled by some unseen current. Carl scrambled back, his heart pounding in his chest. This wasn't right. It wasn't natural. He needed help. He turned and ran back to his cabin, the sound of his breathing loud in his ears. He needed to call Jake and Tom, the only two men in town who might believe him. They had been his friends for years, ever since he'd moved to Whispering Pines. And they had shared enough strange experiences in the woods and on the lake to know that sometimes things happened out here that couldn't be explained. Carl reached his cabin and grabbed the old rotary phone from the wall, dialing Jake's number with shaking fingers. The phone rang once, twice, and then Jake's voice came over the line, gruff and sleepy.
"Yeah?
Jake, it's Carl. I need you to get over here. Now."
"What's going on, Carl? It's the middle of the night."
"Just get over here. And bring Tom. I need to show you something."
There was a pause, and then Jake sighed.
All right. We'll be there in 10.
Carl hung up the phone and began pacing the cabin, his mind racing. He didn't know what was going on, but he knew it was bad. He just hoped that Jake and Tom would be able to help him figure out what to do. The old floorboards creaked under Carl's weight as he anxiously trotted back and forth, doing his best to maintain his composure. The seconds ticked by with agonizing slowness as he waited for Jake and Tom to arrive. Outside, the wind had picked up again, rattling the windows and sending flurries of snow spiraling through the air. He could still hear the faint, otherworldly hum in the distance, the sound seeping into his bones and making his skin crawl. Finally, headlights cut through the darkness, and Carl heard the crunch of tires on snow as Jake's old pickup truck pulled up outside. He grabbed his coat and opened the door just as Jake and Tom were stepping out of the truck. Both men bundled up against the cold. Jake, a burly man with a thick beard and no-nonsense attitude, gave Carl a concerned look as he approached. Tom, leaner and a bit younger, followed close behind, his curiosity evident in his wide eyes.
"What's going on, Carl?"
Jake asked, his voice gruff with sleep. Carl motioned for them to follow him inside, glancing nervously back at the lake as he did. Once they were inside, Carl quickly relayed what he had seen, his words tumbling out in a rush. Jake and Tom listened in silence, their expressions growing more serious by the minute. When Carl finished, there was a heavy silence. Jake scratched his beard thoughtfully, his eyes narrowing.
"A body under the ice, you say? And it was moving?"
Jake's tone was skeptical, but there was a hint of unease in his voice.
"I saw it with my own eyes,"
Carl insisted.
"And the sounds, they're not natural. I don't know what they are, but they're not just ice cracking."
Tom shifted uneasily.
"You think it could be something else? Something not from around here?"
Carl hesitated, his mind racing. He didn't want to jump to conclusions, but deep down, he knew there was something terribly wrong.
"I don't know, but I think we need to find out."
Jake nodded slowly, his skepticism giving way to resolve.
"All right, let's take a look. If there's a body under the ice, we need to know for sure."
The three men bundled up and headed back out into the night. The wind had died down again, leaving the world in an eerie silence, broken only by the crunch of their boots in the snow. Carl led the way to the edge of the lake, the beam of his flashlight retracing the steps he'd taken on his earlier trip. As they reached the spot where Carl had seen the body, the hum returned, louder and more insistent this time. Jake and Tom both froze, their eyes widening as they heard it for the first time. It was a sound that defied explanation. A mix of deep, resonant tones and high-pitched screeches that seemed to come from all directions at once.
"Jesus!"
Tom whispered, his breath fogging the air.
"What the hell is that?"
Carl didn't answer. He was too focused on the ice beneath his feet, desperately searching for the body he had seen previously. But to his horror, it was gone. The ice was perfectly clear, the surface unbroken, as if nothing had ever been there.
It was right here,"
Carl said, his voice tinged with panic.
"I swear, it was right here."
Jake knelt down, pressing his face to the ice.
"I don't see anything. Carl, are you sure you..."
He was cut off as the sound grew even louder, a low rumble that seemed to shake the very ground beneath them. The ice beneath Jake's knees began to crack, spider webs of fractures spreading out from where he knelt. He scrambled back, his face pale.
"Get back!"
Carl shouted, grabbing Jake's arm and pulling him away from the cracking ice. The three men retreated a few steps, watching in horrified fascination as the cracks continued to spread, forming a strange, intricate pattern that none of them could decipher. Tom pointed to the ice, his voice trembling.
"Look at that! It's not just cracking randomly! It's forming something!"
Carl's eyes widened as he realized what Tom was saying. The cracks were forming a symbol, something that looked almost like a glyph or a rune. It was unlike anything Carl had ever seen, a design that seemed calculated in its complexity.
"This isn't natural. This is something else."
Carl didn't need Jake to tell him that. He could feel it in his gut. A deep, instinctual fear that told him they were way in over their heads. But before he could say anything, the ice beneath them began to glow. An eerie blue light pulsing up from the depths of the lake. Tom gasped, stumbling back as the light grew brighter, illuminating the entire lake. The hum had become a roar, vibrating their bodies and making it impossible to think. Carl fell to his knees, clutching his head as the noise threatened to split his skull. And then, just as suddenly as the noise had begun, the noise stopped, the light faded, leaving the lake in shadow once more. The three men lay on the ice, gasping for breath, their minds reeling from what they had just experienced. It was Carl who recovered first, his voice cutting through the silence.
"We need to get out of here. Now."
Jake and Tom didn't argue. They scrambled to their feet, helping each other up as they stumbled back towards the shore. But as they reached the land, Carl turned back for one last look at the lake, his breath caught in his throat as he saw it. A dark shape rising from beneath the ice, its outline blurred by the water. It was enormous, larger than any creature he had ever seen. And as it rose, he could make out the faint glow of lights beneath the surface. Carl didn't want to see more. He turned and ran, his heart pounding in his chest. Whatever that thing was, it wasn't from this world. Carl, Jake, and Tom reached the safety of the tree line, their breaths coming in ragged gasps as they collapsed against the thick trunks of the nearby pines. The bitter cold of the evening seemed to have little effect on them now. They were too shaken by what they had just witnessed. The lake behind them was quiet again, its surface smooth and unbroken, as though the object they had glimpsed was nothing more than a shared nightmare. But Carl knew better. He could still feel the vibrations of the strange hum resonating in his marrow, the afterimage of that otherworldly light lingering in his vision. Whatever they had seen, it was real, and it was dangerous.
"We need to leave,"
Carl said, his voice low and urgent.
"Whatever that thing is, we can't stay here."
Jake nodded, his face pale beneath his beard.
"Agreed. But what the hell are we dealing with here, Carl? That wasn't some freak ice crack. And it sure as hell wasn't anything natural."
Tom, who had been uncharacteristically quiet, finally spoke up, his voice trembling.
"It's them, isn't it? Aliens, or whatever the hell they are. I've heard stories, you know, about strange lights in the sky, people going missing. I never believed it, but now..."
Carl didn't answer. He didn't want to speculate, didn't want to give voice to the fear gnawing at his gut. He just wanted to get as far away from the lake as possible. But as they turned to leave, the hum returned, louder and more intense than before. The ground beneath them shook, and Carl stumbled, barely managing to stay on his feet. Jake and Tom grabbed each other for support, their eyes wide with terror as they looked back towards the lake. The ice was glowing again, but this time it wasn't soft and diffuse. It was blinding, pulsing brightness that shot up from beneath the surface, casting long shadows through the trees. The hum grew in a deafening roar, and the ice began to splinter once more, the fractures spreading out in a rapid, deliberate pattern. Carl's heart raced as he realized what was happening. The cracks were forming yet another symbol, larger and more complex than the first. And this time, they were spreading towards the tree line, towards them.
"We have to move!"
Carl shouted over the noise, grabbing Jake and Tom and pulling them away from the shore, but it was too late. With a deafening explosion, the ice beneath them gave way, and the ground lurched beneath their feet. Tom cried out as he was pulled towards the edge of the breaking ice, his arms flailing as he tried to grab hold of something solid. Carl reached for him, but the ground was slick with snow and ice, and he slipped, falling hard onto the slide. Jake was the first to reach Tom, grabbing him by the collar and pulling him back from the edge. But the ice was relentless, the cracks spreading faster and faster, closing in on them as they scrambled to their feet and ran. Carl's lunges burned with the effort, but he forced himself to keep going, dragging Jake and Tom along with him. They were almost to the safety of the woods when Carl heard the sound that made his pulse quicken. The collapse of ice beneath Jake's feet. Jake's cry of alarm was cut short as the ice gave way beneath him, and he plunged into the freezing water below. Tom screamed and sprang into action, prepared to risk his life to save his friend. But Carl grabbed his arm, pulling him back.
We can't help him!
Carl shouted, choking back tears, his voice raw with emotion.
We have to go!
But Tom wasn't listening. He broke free of Carl's grip and charged in the direction of the lake, desperation overriding his sense of self-preservation. But it was no use. The frigid waters were already draining Jake's strength, his hands clawing at the ice, his eyes wide with terror as the icy grave swallowed him whole. Carl was adamant they were out of time. The ice was still cracking, the light beneath it growing brighter, more intense. He grabbed Tom by the shoulder and shook him, forcing him to focus.
Tom, we have to go. Do you hear me? We have to go now.
Tears streamed down Tom's face, but he nodded, the hopelessness in his eyes nearly breaking Carl's resolve. They turned and ran. The sound of the cracking ice and the blinding light followed them as they fled into the safety of the forest. They didn't stop running until they reached Carl's cabin. Gasping for air, their bodies shaking from more than just the cold. Inside, Carl slammed the door shut and locked it, leaning against the heavy wood as if it could keep out the horrors they had just witnessed. Meanwhile, Tom collapsed to the floor, his hands trembling as he buried his face in them.
He's gone, Carl! Jake's gone! What the hell are we gonna do?
Carl didn't answer right away. He was too busy thinking, trying to make sense of what had happened. But there was no sense to be made. No logical explanation for the things they had seen. All he knew was that they were in danger, and that they needed to get out of there before it was too late.
We're leaving,
Carl finally said, his voice steady despite the fear gnawing at his insides.
We're going to pack up whatever we can and get the hell out of this town tonight.
Tom looked up at him, his eyes hollow.
And then what? Where are we supposed to go?
Anywhere but here,
Carl replied.
We can't stay, Tom. You saw what happened. That thing, whatever it is, it's not going to stop. It's only going to get worse.
Tom nodded, his shoulders slumping in defeat.
Yeah, you're right. Let's get out of here.
They moved quickly, grabbing what little supplies they had and shoving them into bags. Carl kept glancing out the window, half expecting to see the light from the lake creeping towards the cabin. But the night remained dark, the only sound the howling of wind outside. Finally, they were ready. Carl slung his bag over his shoulder and looked at Tom, who was standing by the door, his hand resting on the knob.
Ready?
Carl asked. Tom nodded, but before he could open the door, the hum returned, louder and more menacing than ever. The walls of the cabin shook, and Carl felt the floor beneath him vibrate with the intensity of the sound. They exchanged a panicked glance, and Carl moved to the window, peering out into the night. His heart nearly stopped when he saw it. The ice on the lake was glowing again, brighter and more intense than before, and the light was spreading, moving towards the cabin.
We have to go now,
Carl shouted, grabbing Tom and pulling him towards the back door. But as they reached it, the ground shook violently, and the light outside intensified, flooding the cabin with a blinding glow. Carl threw open the door and they ran, the light and the noise pursuing them as they fled into the darkness. But their pursuers were faster, overtaking them in seconds, and Carl felt his body freeze, paralyzed by the blazing intensity. And then everything went silent. The light vanished, and Carl found himself standing in the darkness, alone.
Tom?
He called out, his voice trembling, but there was no answer. Carl turned in a slow circle, his breath catching in his throat. The night was silent, the wind gone, the echo of the hum receding rapidly. He was alone. And then he saw it. The lake, perfectly still and clear, its surface reflecting the stars above. And there, beneath the ice, was the body of a man, floating just below the surface. Carl's heart stopped as he recognized the face. The lifeless eyes staring up at him and a silent scream. It was Tom. Carl stared in horror at the lifeless body of Tom beneath the ice, his friend's face frozen in a mask of terror. The realization hit him like a punch to the gut. Tom was gone, just like Jake. He felt his knees buckle, the weight of the night's events crashing down on him all at once. The cold seeped into his very bones, but he barely noticed it over the numbness that had taken hold of his mind. He didn't know how long he stood there, staring down at Tom. But eventually, the survival instincts buried deep within him took over. Carr forced himself to turn away from the lake, to tear his eyes from the horrific sight and focus on what needed to be done. He was the only one left. And if he didn't get out of there now, he would be next. Carl stumbled back towards the cabin, every nerve in his body screaming for him to keep moving, to get away from the lake and whatever it was that lurked beneath the ice. The night was eerily silent now, nature itself gone quiet. The hum no longer reverberating through the air. It was as if the world was holding its breath, waiting for him to act. He reached the cabin and threw open the door, his mind racing as he frantically gathered the last of his supplies. He needed to leave, to put as much distance between himself and the lake as possible. But even as he packed, the image of Tom's frozen face lingered in his mind, grief threatening to overwhelm him. Carl was halfway through stuffing a bag with food and blankets when he heard it. A faint, almost imperceptible sound coming from outside. It was soft at first, barely more than a whisper, but it quickly grew louder, filling the cabin with a low, disconcerting rumble. His heart raced as he dropped the bag and ran to the window. The lake was glowing again, but this time the light was different. It was pulsating slowly, as if the very earth beneath the lake was alive and breathing. The hum intensified, shaking the cabin's walls and vibrating through Carl's chest like a living thing. Carl knew what was coming. The light would spread, the ice would crack, and then he would be next. But something inside him snapped, a primal instinct that had lain dormant until now. He refused to die like this. Not after everything he'd been through. Not without a fight. He grabbed his bag and slung it over his shoulder, running to the back door. As he reached for the handle, he heard the ice outside begin to crack, the sound echoing through the night like a gunshot. He knew he didn't have much time. Carl burst through the door and into the night, the freezing air biting at his skin. The light from the lake was growing brighter, casting an eerie glow over the trees and snow. He didn't dare look back. He couldn't afford to lose even a second. He ran as fast as his legs would carry him, his breath coming in ragged gasps, his heart pounding in his ears. The hum followed him, growing louder and louder, until it felt like the very air was vibrating with the sound. The light was spreading, creeping towards him, and he knew that if he didn't get away now, he would be swallowed by it, just like Jake and Tom. But as he reached the edge of the woods, something strange happened. The light stopped spreading, halting just at the tree line. The hum faded, replaced by a deafening silence that pressed in on Carl from all sides. He slowed to a stop, his chest heaving as he tried to catch his breath. The world around him was still, the only sound the crunch of snow beneath his boots. Slowly, hesitantly, Carl turned back to look at the lake. The light was gone. The ice appeared perfectly smooth and clear, as if nothing had ever happened. The night was dark, the stars twinkling innocently overhead. It was as if the lake had returned to its natural state, erasing all traces of the horror that had just unfolded. But Carl knew better. He could feel it in his soul. A deep, unsettling certainty that the danger was far from over. The lake might be quiet now, but whatever was down there was still waiting, still watching. It had claimed Jake and Tom, and it would continue if it weren't stopped. But Carl couldn't put an end to it. Not alone. He needed help. and he needed to get as far away from Whispering Pines as possible before the lake returned for him. He turned and continued running, the darkness of the woods swallowing him up as he fled. He didn't know where he was going or what he would do when he arrived. All he knew was that he had to survive, warn people, and ensure no one else ended up like Jake and Tom. Carl sprinted until he was miles away from Blackwater Shores, his inhalation shallow and painful. He stumbled through the snow, his body aching with exhaustion and cold. But he couldn't let himself rest. Not yet. Not until he was far enough away to be safe. Finally, he reached the edge of the woods, where the trees began to thin out, giving way to the snow-covered fields that stretched out towards the distant town. He could see the faint glow of lights in the distance, a sign that he was nearing civilization. He was almost there. But as Carl stood at the edge of the forest, catching his breath and trying to steady his racing heart, he heard it again. The faint, unmistakable droning. At the moment, it was soft, barely perceptible, but it was there, coursing through the air and sending waves of goosebumps up and down his arms. He turned slowly, dread pooling in his stomach as he looked back towards the woods. There, through the trees, he could see the faint glow of pulsating cerulean light. The hum grew louder, and Carl's blood ran cold. It was following him. Whatever was in the lake, whatever had taken Jake and Tom, wasn't finished yet. It was coming for him. Determined to conclude its fiendish game of cat and mouse, Carl's legs trembled, his body screaming at him to run, but he couldn't move. He was frozen in place, paralyzed by the fear that gripped him like a vice. The light was getting closer, the telltale thrum rising to a crescendo as his predators approached, and Carl knew that there was no escape. Not this time. He closed his eyes, bracing himself for the inevitable. But just as the light was about to overtake him, it stopped. The inhuman murmur faded, leaving only the sound of the wind rustling through the trees. Trepidatiously, Carl opened his eyes, his heart still hammering in his chest. The woods were dark and still, and Carl slumped to his knees, exhausted, teetering on the verge of madness. Once again, he'd been spared. But why? 6 months later, the sun blazed overhead as Carl walked along the sandy shore of a secluded tropical beach. The sun blazed overhead as Carl walked along the sandy shore of a secluded tropical beach. The warm, salty breeze ruffled his thinning hair, and the sound of the waves crashing gently against the shore was a soothing balm to his frayed nerves. After leaving Whispering Pines, Carl had traveled far as he could, seeking refuge in a place that was the complete opposite of the cold, foreboding lake that had nearly claimed his life. Here, on this small coastal island in the Caribbean, Carl had found some semblance of peace. The days were filled with sunshine and warmth, the nights quiet and calm, the sound of the ocean lulling him to sleep. But sometimes, even in the midst of paradise, when the sun dipped below the horizon and the shadows grew long, Carl would find himself listening for the faint hum, the one that had haunted him in his frozen wilderness. It never came, but the fear remained, ever present, at the edges of his consciousness. One afternoon, after a leisurely swim, Carl decided to take a walk along the shore. The tide was low, revealing a series of shallow tide pools nesting among the rocks. Brimming with life, the water was so clear that he could see every detail of the coral and the small, colorful fish that darted in and out of the crevices. As he walked, Carl's thoughts drifted back to the life he had left behind, the friends he had lost. The warmth of the sun on his skin and the beauty of his surroundings did little to ease the ache in his chest. He had come here to forget, but some things were impossible to leave behind. He was about to turn back when something in one of the tide pools caught his eye. It was just a glimmer, a flash of light reflecting off the water's surface, but it drew his attention. Carl stepped closer. peering down into the pool. At first, he saw nothing out of the ordinary, just sand, shells, and strands of seaweed. But as he looked closer, a chill ran down his spine. There, beneath the surface, partially obscured by the shifting sands, was the outline of a human face. Carl's breath caught in his throat. The face was pale, almost translucent, with wide, unseeing eyes. The mouth was slightly agape, as if frozen in a silent scream. He knew that face. It was the same one he had seen beneath the ice at Blackwater Lake. His heart pounded in his chest, nearly losing his footing on the slick rocks. The tide pool began to shimmer, the water rippling as if disturbed by an unseen force. Carl's mind raced, his thoughts a jumbled mess of fear and disbelief. No, his mind reeled. It couldn't be. He was thousands of miles away, in a different world, warm, beautiful, and safe. This wasn't possible. But the evidence was right in front of him, staring up at him with cold, dead eyes. The all-too-familiar droning returned, faint at first, but growing louder with each passing second. The water in the tide pool began to glow, a ghoulish blue light that pooled rhythmically, in time with the sound. Carl took another step back, his instincts screaming at him to run for his life, but he couldn't tear his eyes away from the sight before him. The body beneath the water began to move, drifting slowly toward the surface, as if reaching for him. Carl turned and ran, his feet slipping on the wet sand as he fled down the beach. The hum made chase, growing louder, more insistent. The light from the tide pool casting strange shadows on the land. He didn't dare look back. He knew what he would see. He reached the bungalow and slammed the door behind him, struggling to keep his wits about him. The hum was omnipresent, vibrating through the walls, the floor, his very being. Carl grabbed his bag and began stuffing it with whatever essentials he could find. A moment later, as if the futility of his efforts had finally become clear, Carl's hope disintegrated, and he stopped everything he was doing. The nightmare had followed him across oceans, across continents. There was no escaping it. Carl calmly exited the bungalow, expressionless, and for the first time, laid eyes directly on the source of his torment, and knelt to his knees, defeated. The beach was bathed in a blinding flash, the brightness searing Carl's vision. The light enveloped him, and with a final, deafening shriek of agony, Carl Donovan vanished. When the light finally faded, the tide pool was empty, the water clear and still. The sun dipped toward the horizon, casting long, golden shadows across the beach. The warm breeze rustled the palm trees, and the waves lapped gently at the shore. To any observer, the scene was idyllic, serene. Paradise undisturbed. Epilogue. Halfway across the world, in a remote village nestled deep within the mountains, a young woman stood by the edge of a glacial lake. The air was crisp, the water still and clear, reflecting the towering peaks surrounding it. As she knelt to dip her hand into the icy water, a strange shimmer caught her eye. She paused, her fingers hovering just above the surface, and leaned closer. There, beneath the water, something glowed faintly, a cerulean light that seemed to pulse with a life of its own, beckoning her nearer. And then the hum began, soft at first but growing louder, filling the air with its haunting resonance. The light grew stronger, rippling just beneath the surface, and as she peered closer, the young woman saw a face staring back at her, pale and lifeless, with its eyes wide and its mouth frozen in a silent scream. She clutched at her chest as recognition dawned. The face was that of a man, his features twisted in terror. It was Carl.
I hope you enjoyed The Body in the Lake, as written by Craig Groeschek and performed by Matthew Ferrugia and Mike Lauer. You can find more of Chilling Tales for Dark Nights newcomer Mike Lauer on his very own podcast, Amperitif, by visiting www.amperitif.com. On to the shows. As mentioned earlier, Otis Gyre and Kevin Barbieri have their very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. We also have Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Fridays, featuring some Southern down-home horror. And don't forget to check out the Fear from the Heartland archives, featuring more than 120 episodes. Also, don't forget, we have our very own book out. Since 2012, Chilling Tales for Dark Nights has been keeping people awake through the night with terrifying audio renditions of tales from the darkest minds modern memory has to offer. Now, in this first of three volumes, collected are 30 tales never before available by some of the most prolific and talented authors of the online community, each one accompanied by a suitably grim illustration by David Romero. Strange cats, body mutilations, demonic apartments, revenge from beyond the grave, and yes, even a man-eating monster or two. All of these and more beckon you further into the darkness. Turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Who needs sleep anyway? Check it out at Amazon today or by visiting www.chillingbook.com. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word. And follow us on Facebook, X, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.